I have discovered that I'm actually doing a series of four sermons, this being the third. Took me a while to figure it out, but here we go. 2 weeks ago, what we talked about was free will. It always comes up in the context of Pharaoh. Did God override Pharaoh's free will? We talked about that, and what we talked about was the contrast between secularism and Calvinism and the way Jews think about it. In secularism, free will doesn't exist because everything is chemical processes. So if you know the chemistry and you know what the initial conditions are, everything's predictable. There's a Hebrew word for that. It's called baloney. Calvinism is of the opinion that you can't do anything contrary to your own nature. And since you are by nature a sinner, that means that you can't come to God on your own, so God has got to grab you. I don't agree with that. Rabbi Sacks, who I was reading when I started thinking about all this, and I like his quote, "Freedom is a muscle that needs to be exercised, use it or lose it." So in Judaism, the idea is God has given us a whole bunch of tools. He's given us the Torah, he's given us his word, he's given us his spirit, etc. And what he wants us to do with those is develop our character so that we can freely choose and change our nature. Remember, Calvinism says that you're by nature a sinner, so you can't choose God. What Judaism and I believe is God has given you tools so you can change your nature, and then you can freely come to God. So that was what we talked about 2 weeks ago. So then last week, we talked about the idea that God introduces liberty at the Passover. In order to exercise liberty, you got to know who you are. So what God does is he adopts us into his family. Remember, he said, "Israel is my firstborn." So Israel has been adopted. We have a relationship to God. And in last week's Torah portion, he tells us over and over again, teach your children, which is to say, bring your children up in this, because without context, you can't be free. Liberty and worship both require context. And we talked at Midrash, I didn't talk in here, so those of you who weren't in Midrash didn't get this. But one of the things that Rabbi Foreman was talking about is the idea that the Passover and getting Lot out of Sodom is exactly the same story. And the only difference between the two is it's exactly reversed. So every event that happens in the Exodus also happens with Lot, but reversed. If you remember the story of Lot and Sodom, Lot has to be blasted out of there. He doesn't want to leave. So the angel has to grab him and haul him out of there, and his wife is so upset about the thing that she keeps looking back and gets turned into a pillar of salt. So even though the place is evil, Lot doesn't want to leave. What happens in the Passover is God arranges it so that Egypt kicks Israel out. He doesn't depend on Israel to come out by themselves. He sets things up so that the Egyptians drive them out, literally. And what he's doing today is he is setting up a situation where they learn his character and they learn to trust him. So that's what we're going to talk about today. How does God teach Israel what his character is, and how does he teach them to trust him? Let's start at the beginning of today's Torah portion. I'm in Exodus 13, 17. "When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistine, although that was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt." So the first thing as they go out, God is going to lead them to a place where they can't return. So he's going to take them out into the desert. He's going to run them beyond the limits of the water they have. He's going to run them beyond the limits of the food they have. So they're out there in the wilderness, and the only way they could get back is if God provided for them on the way back. There's a book that Kay and I both like. It's called The Last Place on Earth. And what it is the story of the discovery of the South Pole by Scott and Amundsen. The problem that the expedition has is there's no service stations between the coast and the South Pole. So what they do is they take caches of food and they go out as far as they can go halfway, leave a cache, come back, get another cache of food, go to the first cache, and then leapfrog to the second cache, put a cache of food there, and so forth until they have got steps from the coast to the South Pole. Because if they tried to go to the South Pole without doing that, they would die of starvation either before they got there, which is most likely, or they wouldn't be able to get back. So what God is doing with Israel is he's taking them away from Egypt, which is where their security was, and he's taking them out so far that they can't get back on their own. What God is doing is taking away from them any option except to trust him. And that's what's going on in that first passage that I read. He didn't take them the short way up to the land of the Philistines. He took them out into the wilderness. And it happens over and over again, by the way, in today's Torah portion, where when things get rough, they run out of water, they run out of food, etc., they all say, "Why did you take us out of Egypt? Did you bring us out here to die?" That's sort of a perennial complaint, which is to say that if it were physically possible for them to do, they would turn around and go back. They'd rather be enslaved than thirsty or hungry out in the desert. God knows that. So as you look at the physical sequence of events, what becomes very obvious, God is setting things up so that the only option they've got is to trust him. That's it. And by the way, he tests them three times. There were two in today's Torah portion, and the next one is going to be at the beginning of next week's Torah portion. For those of you who have been teachers, there's two purposes for a test. Purpose number one is quality control. The students that I am turning out, have they learned the material that I expect them to have learned in order to give them a stamp that they have passed this class? Quality control. But the second one is even more important. And what it does is passing a test gives the student confidence that he knows something. What's happening in the tests, if you will, that God does in the wilderness is God is building up Israel's confidence that, yes, you can trust me. Yes, you know something. Yes, you can do this. I don't think God is worried too much about the quality control part. He knows what they know and what they don't know. And I think the tests are for the second reason, which is to build up their confidence. So we have three things in today's Torah portion. The first is the water crisis. They go across the Red Sea and they hit Marah, and the water's bitter. And they throw the log into the water and the water becomes sweet. The second water crisis is, of course, where we are out at Horeb, which is a long way away, and Moses strikes the rock and they get water there. So those are the two water crises we have. Then we have a food crisis. Now, I got to tell you, I'm not sure I understand the food crisis because they got flocks and herds. If you're hungry, just slaughter a sheep. I don't know why that is set up that way, but it is. Moses wrote this. This is what's going on. And I don't know whether they slaughtered all the sheep they had, but that doesn't seem to be the case because they had lots of flocks and herds and were able to sacrifice when they set up the tabernacle. But anyway, we had the business with the manna and the quail. Quail are going to show up again later in a much more grumpy way. And then the last thing we have today is where they have military victory over Amalek. So three things happen here. One is you can trust God for water. Two is you can trust God for food. And three, you can trust God for victory. So this is all a process, if you will, building up Israel. The other thing is this is all done in the context of Shabbat, because the first rule he gives them is Shabbat. They don't get Shabbat for the first time at Mount Sinai. They get it here in the context of the manna. And what he's doing is he's teaching them his character. So he gives them an omer of manna every day. And then those of them who are prudent, like I would be, well, okay, we got manna today, but what's going to happen tomorrow? I guess I'll save some of it for tomorrow. No, that isn't going to work. I'll make it rot and stink and breed worms. So you can't do that. This is by way of giving them no options. Just like he ran them clear out into the wilderness, so they've got no option to return because they'll starve to death or die of thirst before they get back. So they're stuck out there in the wilderness. So then we do the same thing with the manna. I'll give you one day of manna at a time, and you got to trust me for the manna tomorrow because I won't let you save it. And then on Friday, I'm going to give you a double portion so you don't have to work on my Shabbat. Again, teaching them to trust him. And so they get the double portion and they do whatever they're going to do with it. Some of them try and go out and get some more on Shabbat, and there isn't any there, and Moses yells at them. So what he's teaching them is, you can trust me for your daily food, and when it comes time for you not to work, you can trust me there too, because I will make sure that you have enough to eat. So what he's doing is he's teaching them about himself. And by the way, the word Omer only shows up in this context. It does not show up anywhere else in the Hebrew Bible. And one of the things that's really kind of fascinating is sort of the last thing that was said is an Omer is a tenth of an ephah. Now, why do they say that? Well, the reason they say that is because all of the temple sacrifices and the grain offerings are given in terms of tenths of an ephah. So if it wasn't for that little phrase, you wouldn't recognize that a tenth of an ephah is an Omer. And the daily sacrifice every day is a lamb and one Omer of grain. Except on Shabbat, where it's two lambs and two Omers of grain, two tenths of an ephah. So all of this is, if you will, by way of teaching them God's ways, teaching them that he can be trusted, teaching them that he will do what he says he would do. And oh, by the way, if he doesn't, you got no choice whatsoever because you're going to die in the wilderness. As I say, he's deliberately set it up that way, and you can see it, because given their own druthers, when things got tough, they would turn around and beat feet back to Egypt. We like being slaves better than we like being out here. Now, the other thing is, we are created in the image of God. And God rested on the Sabbath. That's the first thing in Genesis. After the 6 days of creation, then God rests. It's the first chapter in the Bible. So God rested, but we are in his image. So as his children, if he rests, so should we. God is not a slave. Neither are you. Slaves don't get to rest on Shabbat. Slaves just keep working. So what God is doing is teaching them to trust him and teaching them in the process how to be free. Because that's not something they understand. They haven't done it in 400 years. So in order to get them to be free, he's got to teach them what it looks like. And he has set it up so they got no choice. You will be free. Otherwise, you can wander off into the desert and die, because if you don't stay in the camp and if you don't learn how to be free, the alternative is death and slavery, which, by the way, is the alternative to being free. It's all a perfect metaphor. Now, where we are in the story is we are in what's called the Omer period. We will actually do it here on the ground when we get to Passover. From Passover until Shavuot is a period that's called counting the Omer. In the story in Exodus, that is the period they're in right now, is the place from the Exodus till they get to Sinai. And the Omer is only mentioned in this story. And it's interesting because what it does is it takes 50 days to transition from being a slave to being free. You've all heard this lots of times. The sequence is 7 times 7 plus 1. You will count for yourself 7 Sabbaths, each Sabbath being 7 days. So you have 49 days plus one more. What that is the time from being a slave to a free man. And interestingly, the Passover starts at the barley harvest. It finishes at the wheat harvest. So barley at Passover, wheat at Shavuot. And that's symbolic because barley is regarded as a less desirable grain. It's typically something that is given as fodder for animals, or you feed your slaves. The good stuff is wheat. So symbolically, they are moving from being cattle, chattel, if you will, eating barley, to being free, eating wheat. All of this is very carefully structured. There's nothing accidental in any of this. So what they are doing is during this 50-day period, they are transitioning from being beasts of burden to free men. It's the whole purpose of the exercise. And he gets tested three times. Now, in order to learn to be free, you got to know who you are. We started with free will, where you learn to exercise your ability to decide things that are not necessarily part of your nature. In fact, we learn how to change our nature so that our nature becomes more fully human. That's the problem the Israelites have. They are not by nature free. They are not by nature fully human. They are by nature slaves. And so we have this process where God is changing them from slaves to free men. In order to do that, he adopts them into his family. Israel is God's firstborn. And of course, through the sacrifice of Yeshua, we have the ability also to be adopted into God's family. That's the whole purpose of the resurrection. You now get to become sons and daughters of God. See the parallels here? The only place where freedom resides is within the family of God. Everywhere else, what it is master-slave relationships. You either get to be the master or you get to be the slave. The slave is a generic term. I mean, there are degrees of slavery, if you know what I'm saying. And even the master tends to be a slave to sin. So the only place where true freedom exists is within the family of God. God starts with Israel as his firstborn, and then the idea is to expand to the rest of the world to give anybody the ability to become a child of God. If we abandon the kingdom and we abandon our heritage, remember, Moses says over and over again, teach your children. Explain to them what's going on. Explain to them what God did for you. Explain to them what these rituals and feasts mean. Because what you're doing is you're giving them context as members of the family of God. And if you lose that, the alternative is slavery. Unless you happen to be one of the masters, and then you get to be a master, but then you become slave to sin, not to God. So I'm going to close with John chapter 8. That's where Yeshua is duking it out with the Pharisees. John 8:31. So Yeshua said to the Jews who believed in him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." They answered him, "We are offspring of Abraham, and we've never been enslaved by anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?" Now, this is while they're up to their hips in Romans. The idea is, well, we're not slaves. Yeshua answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed." Notice, family. If you are in the family of God, the son will set you free. And if you are set free by the son, you will be free indeed. Now, what's going on with Israel? Why are we having this problem where they say, "What are you talking about?" The problem is Israel is on cruise control. They think they've got the word of God, and they're just like pretty much any other church in the world. They're on cruise control. They're not working on developing their character. They're not working on exercising their freedom muscles. They are just sort of cruising along. Go back to Rabbi Sacks. Freedom is a muscle that needs to be exercised. Use it or lose it. And our tendency is to get complacent, to sit on our blessed assurance with our hands over our tummy and think, "Yeah, everything's fine. Don't have to worry. I got enough to eat. I go to church every Shabbat or Sunday or whenever you go to church." And that's what's happening with Israel. They're on cruise control. And so what Yeshua does, just like God is doing to Israel in the wilderness, making them uncomfortable. And the thing that he is making them uncomfortable about is they are no longer free. They're not exercising this liberty muscle that God wants them to exercise. Now, today's Torah portion, what God is doing is teaching them what that muscle looks like and how it feels. They should know that. But again, we see in the history of Israel over and over and over again, which is why the Bible is such a wonderful resource, people, I'm not knocking the Israelites, but people tend to go on cruise control and tend to lapse back into slavery. It takes work not to be a slave. Slavery is easy. They got to feed you. They got to tell you what to do. You don't have to make big decisions. You just go along. And that's why Israel keeps trying to go back to Egypt as things get rough in the wilderness. Slavery is more comfortable. And that's where a lot of us are. Is we haven't exercised our liberty muscles. And go along, get along, slaves, whatever, is easy. There's that internet meme that I like. It's got a picture of George Washington. And it says, George would have been stacking bodies by now. Because we have given up our liberties. They didn't get taken from us. We gave them up. And we gave them up for security. We gave them up for go along, get along. We gave them up for all sorts of reasons. And so what this sequence that we're going through in Exodus is the process by which God teaches you how to be free. And we'll finish that up next week when we get to the Ten Commandments, because that's the capstone of this process. The capstone of that process is Ten Commandments, wherein liberty lies. And I'll talk about that next week.